I'll tell you what I will tell you about. Actually, I'm supposed just to thank the organizers of the workshop, but I do not see one. Anyways, let me start with thanking the organizers for organizing this workshop. And so basically, I will tell you about some numerical approach. It's called diagrammatic Monte Carlo, which is a very relevant for the problem of BCS to BSC crossover. And actually, diagrammatic Monte Carlo is a generic name for the approach which somehow works with diagrammatic expansions. And in each case, you need just to come up with a particular algorithm. So actually, there will be two parts. One will be about just the standard BCS, BSC crossover problem when we have a balanced system, because if the system is unbalanced, Monte Carlo suffers. I just thank the organizers of the workshop. Okay. One problem will be about just the standard BCS BSC crossover with a balanced gas when the pairing is the S channel, just the standard classical statement of the problem, and it turns out that we can just solve it. It's a painful calculation, but doable, so with controllable accuracy. And the second part is just the farm fresh, actually preliminary results, which were obtained just this week. Nikolai Prokofiev and me at the moment are working on the problem of so-called Fermi polaron. It is an extremely unbalanced system, and we have just one particle of different sorts. So you have an ideal gas of fermions, say spin-up fermions, and just one spin-down fermion. And the question is, what happens to this Fermi polaron? Actually, there is a sort of phase transition, because the guy can be a fermion if the interaction is not strong enough, but it can become a boson by pairing. And so basically the main question is when this pairing happens. And this problem may be relevant actually to the phase diagram of the balanced system if this point is stable. If it's not stable, still this is an interesting single particle problem. What happens to a single particle when we just put it in a resonant Fermi, Fermi C? So in terms of this second part, my only co-author is Nikolai. And in terms of the first part, we have two students, Evgeny Burovsky, who was our student at UMass, and now he is a postdoc at Greifswald, Germany. Evgeny Kozik is still our student, but soon he will become a shared postdoc between ETH and UMass. And actually, he will go to Zurich to work with us and Matthias Tröhr. And Nikolai Prokofiev, just you've seen him here, and you know him very well. And Matthias Tröhr, of course, is a known person in this community. Actually, in this first part of the problem, we were heavily using computational resources. And the first crucial step in this problem, basically the unitarity point, was done on the Oak Ridge Cray supercomputer, the fastest vector machine. One of the fastest vector machines in the world. Unfortunately, we don't have an access to this guy any longer. That's why we have just to start thinking how to improve our scheme. And we actually came to a better one, which actually can work on clusters. So we do not need a supercomputer any longer, but we need a really huge clusters. Okay, so. Well, let me just start with, basically there will be three parts. First I will introduce you to diagrammatic Monte Carlo as some generic method. Then I will describe what we are doing in terms of BCS, BSC crossover, and then we will start discussing Fermi polaron. So what's diagrammatic Monte Carlo? Suppose you have some diagrammatic series. Just for simplicity, and actually it's a good introduction to the diagrammatic Monte Carlo, you have a diagrammatic series for a polaron. So you have a particle which interacts with phonon. So this is the particle Green's function, and these guys are phonon propagators. So that's the expression for the polaron Green's function. And if this expression is positive, definite, and if this series is convergent, we are in business and we can just do our Monte Carlo.
Positive, definite, term by term.
Term by term, right. In principle, if it's not positive definite, it's not a big deal. The crucial question here is convergence. Once we are doing a kind of few body problem, the sign is not really important, as we will see with Fermi polaron. The series will be not positive definite. In that case, the sign will be crucial for convergence. But just for simplicity, imagine that each term is positive definite and the series is convergent. So what
propagators are imaginary time propagators.
Perfect, exactly. So if we work in imaginary time and momentum representation, everything is positive definite. If we work in with frequency and momentum, the series is not necessarily positive definite. So basically, that's really important. So we have to work in imaginary time just to have this guy positive definite. Absolutely. So. So we can look at this expression actually as if this Green's function as a partition function with respect to some ensemble of graphical objects. So basically, we say that all the continuous variables, all the momenta and imaginary times are just some continuous parameters of our objects, and the integration with respect to them should be understood as some averaging over the ensemble of graphical objects. And in this ensemble, each graphical object is characterized by fixed variables, in contrast to what we are doing analytically. So if I take one diagram, by diagram, I mean the graphical object when all the internal and external, of course, variables are fixed at some values. Then I just can interpret my Green's function as if it's some ensemble averaging over these graphical objects. I just can pretend that I also integrate with respect to the external parameter. And then my Green's function is nothing else than the distribution function of these graphical objects with respect to the total line length in imaginary time, if I integrate with respect to imaginary time. And then my only problem is just to arrange such a Markov process which would just sample this ensemble. So basically, I will generate this ensemble by some Markov process, and then I will just sample my Green's function in the form of a histogram out of my representative ensemble. Well, how can we arrange such a process in practice? It's very simple. So basically, the prescription is we need to come up with pairs of complementary updates. Say update A in a pair AB creates a new element. The simplest case is that we just create a new propagator, like in this picture. We just create a new propagator. And the complementary update B just removes this propagator. And basically, in this case, this is almost enough. The only update which we need to add is just the update which will change the length of the whole thing, because we remember that Green's function actually will be sampled as the distribution of lengths in the imaginary time. But it's a kind of trivial update. And that's it. So then we just should guarantee that our Markov process samples the correct distribution, because so far we haven't discussed the values, the physical or mathematical values of the diagrams. And the math is very simple. It's almost the standard Metropolis algorithm plus some extra feature. So Metropolis algorithm is as follows. You just create a new object, and you either accept this update or reject it, depending on so-called acceptance ratio, which typically is the ratio of the new of the value which you ascribe to a new object over the value which you were ascribing to the old object. But in the case of diagrams, this is a dimensional quantity. It cannot be a probability, because this ratio is interpreted as a probability. If it's larger than unity, you just accept you just accept the update, and that's it. If it's smaller than unity, you just interpret it as this ratio as acceptance probability, and just accept the update with the given probability R. In our case, this ratio would be a dimensional quantity, and just if you work out the math, you will see that there is yet another guy which enters the expression because of these continuous variables. This is the distribution function with which we seed the new variables when we do our updates. For example, when we insert a new propagator, we have to figure out what will be the moments of imaginary times and what will be the momentum which we will be ascribing to this propagator. So this vector x is the vector of new continuous parameters like momenta and times which we ascribe just to the new created object. And correspondingly, when we perform the complementary update b, which will be removing these extra variables and this extra graphical structure, this guy, this distribution function, will enter the expression for the acceptance ratio. And that's it. So basically, that's all about the diagrammatic Monte Carlo. This function, generally speaking, is arbitrary dense, doesn't depend on this function, but the performance of the code, in principle, depends on it. So it's a good idea just to choose this function in some optimal way. So now let's just recall what we mean by the resonant ferment, because we will be applying this to... Yes?
What is the difference between this diagrammatic Monte Carlo and what is called path integral Monte Carlo?
It's a good question. So typically, there were two versions of Metropolis algorithm. Either you work with discrete objects, like with understanding how to work, say, with discrete series. You just go from one term to another. It's a discrete update, no continuous variables involved. Or you just have a lot of continuous variables, like in a path, but the number is fixed. So basically, you just shift. There are no complementary pairs of updates because the update in path integral in this sense is self-complementary. Because if you can shift one variable this direction, you can also shift it backwards. So there is no such a problem as a pair of complementary updates when you create new continuous variables and then you remove them. That was the only problem why people were discretizing the imaginary time, for example, for discrete models. For continuous models, it's a must, but for discrete models, just you don't need to discretize imaginary time if you use diagrammatic Monte Carlo. Okay, so I believe that everyone here knows what is the model of resonant ferment, but just to make sure that we are on the same page, here is a quick reminder. So the model is actually the model in which the interaction is replaced by a boundary condition. So we have two species fermions. Formally they do not interact through some potential, but there is a special boundary condition which takes place when just two coordinates of opposite particles come close enough to each other. So we require that the structure of the wave function should be like some A, which is the function of the rest of the variables, and some function B, which is also the function of the rest of the variables. And the ratio of the two, B over A, which has the dimensionality of momentum, should be some given constant. So in vacuum, if we would have just two particles in vacuum, the meaning of this constant C is very simple. It's up to a constant, actually, which is probably unity as far as I remember. It's just the inverse S scattering length. In a finite system, the scattering length makes little sense in the region when C is on the order of unity. So just C is just a good microscopic parameter. So we have two regimes. When C is much larger than Fermi momentum, we have a BCS regime. The system is a weakly interacting one, and we have just standard Bardeen-Cooper-Schrieffer pairing. When C is negative and its absolute value is much larger than K Fermi, actually we have a compact pairs of fermions, and this is DC regime, Bose-Einstein condensation of pairs. And the regime of our interest is the unitary regime when actually C is much smaller, formally is zero, but for all practical purposes, when it's much smaller than Fermi momentum, we have some special regime which is needed for the Kupfer-Schrodinger bose-Einstein condensate of molecules, some strongly correlated regime. And that's the regime which we want to simulate.
I have a question.
Yes?
So about a week ago, you were complaining that these problems often is a possibility of collapse. But by formulating it like this, you probably exclude this possibility.
Oh, it's a really good question. Looks like people didn't realize that there is such a problem. And the first, I believe the first author who realized it was Birch. And this problem actually was called Birch's problem. It's a famous problem. He actually asked, he wrote the question whether the model is stable when c equals zero. It was just a very sharp question. And numeric simulations demonstrated that it is stable. But you're absolutely right. A priori, we do not know whether the model is stable or not if we just write it like that. Because there are.
So what you argue is that if you actually did introduce short-range attractive interactions, then it would be unstable.
Say it again?
If you, instead of putting in boundary conditions, you would actually try to solve numerically the Schrodinger equation with short-range attractive interactions close to resonance, then the model would be unstable.
Absolutely.
The other bound states.
It excludes the possibility of all particles being within the range of the potential.
Right.
But it's a great question. So it's the famous Birch's problem, which is now believed to be solved by numerics at least. But it was just, I don't know how many years ago, maybe 5 years ago, just the nuclear people, because basically it's all about dilute nuclear matter. So the nuclear people were very interested in this problem. So it's the crust of the neutron star, dilute neutron matter, because with dilute neutron matter, we have exactly this situation. We have a parameter of about 10. So the distance between the S scattering length of two neutrons is almost by a factor of 10. As far as I remember, it's about 6. So larger than the typical range of the interactions. So that's why they were very interested in this problem. And the first question just was whether this model makes any physical sense, whether it's stable or not. And now it's known that it is stable. So basically, the main question about this model is the question of the critical temperature, and this is the illustration of a lot of publications trying to figure out what's this temperature, basically there is our work which I will be describing today, and there is yet another work which was done a bit earlier by the group of Oral Bulgak, which they claim just different number, and a recent work which claim even more different number. But in this case, the algorithm which was used was biased. That's why I called my talk unbiased approaches. So here we cannot guarantee the accuracy because it's so-called fixed node Monte Carlo, which contains some uncontrollable systematics. Also, there is an experiment, but we shouldn't take seriously this experimental point because it's not a bare observation of the critical temperature. It's just observation plus some assumption basically involving theories like that. So just we should not take this point as experimental. But after all, if we just look at this cluster of points, we will see that basically all of them are reasonable because talking of analytics, it's analytics without small parameter, and it predicts the number about 0.2, which is the critical temperature in the BC limit, with the error bar, with the systematic error bar about 50 to 100%. That's what one would expect from just a theory without small parameter. And the discrepancy between these two points will be discussed a bit later. Actually, the point will be that they do not have an access to dilute enough system. So basically, the system is dense, so that they do not really simulate the unitarity.
I kind of like this picture. And one thing I noticed is that the more trustworthy theoretical calculation is, the closer it is to your point.
When you have a theory which predicts a number of order unity, it's like, I don't know, like random number generator. So the most closest point doesn't necessarily mean that it's most trustworthy. It may be just a coincidence. You need to predict a lot of stuff. So you need to predict critical temperature, thermodynamic curves, and so on and so on. If everything will coincide with the numerics, then you can say that it's the most
I'm just judging that the paper by Son and Nikolic and Sajtiev are the only one who did some. They introduced an additional small parameter. And
Right, but then they were speculating that the other terms are small, which they do not know.
But the other theoretical paper, they just didn't control the approximation.
So I agree, but still, just if so, these are reasonable considerations that probably the terms which are not taken into account are small. But who knows? Because they're on the order of unity. But yes, so maybe it's not a coincidence. Maybe it's something just okay. But just I will show you that this point is known with great accuracy because we found it for two different representations. Okay, so basically, we cannot actually solve the resonant model as it is for many body system, and the main problem is the problem of sign. So with fermions, the main problem is the problem of sign. So we actually have to use some model in which our approach will be free of the sign problem. And there are two characteristic cases which we can use. One is the Hubbard model. We can just take a Hubbard model, fine-tune it to the resonant point, and just go to the dilute regime. Or,
excuse me, by the sign problem, you mean that not all terms in this series are
I will explain what's the sign problem a little bit later. So where does it? You know that all fermionic diagrams, generally speaking, contain the sign which comes from the fermionic loops. That's the typical fermionic sign problem. Okay.
I don't understand why it is a problem.
Oh, you don't understand why it is a problem. Because now if each diagram has a sign, you will be summing them.
Oh, okay.
And basically you will be summing, suppose you have an exponential like e to the minus 100. Each term is huge, but the answer is negligibly small. So, there will be no accuracy.
Very large positive and negative.
Just the error bars will be like 10 to the 10th power larger than the answer, So and vacuum. Okay. So and another way is to introduce a continuous space model with delta functional interaction. You will see that delta functional interaction will be really important. Otherwise, we would have sign problem in our approach. So. But the model with delta functional interaction is singular, so we need to regularize it, and the simplest way to regularize it is to declare that actually the dispersion law for our particles is k squared over 2m only up to some cutoff momentum, and then it's infinity. So basically we do not have momentum larger than some momentum k naught. But you see that these two approaches are just pretty close to each other. Here we just have almost the same. We have some cutoff because we have a Brillouin zone. We just have two different dispersion relations. Otherwise, these two approaches are pretty close to each other. And it's important to understand, it can be easily, you can easily figure it out, that there will be a finite density correction which will scale like the cube of density. So it's not a really good news. So because you see that the density dependence is very weak. But on the good side, we will see that this asymptotic regime, when the correction scales like the cube of density, sets in pretty early, so you can just extrapolate. But we have to remember that there will be always a correction, and this correction actually comes from a specific resonant dependence of T matrix. So basically, this correction is totally due to the specific resonant dependence of matrix gamma on the external momenta and frequencies. Okay, so here are the diagrams.
Could you, in principle, adjust the model to set that leading
Oh, it's a good question. In principle, it should be possible. We have some control parameters, but we didn't do that. We didn't do that, and in principle, it was our idea. Why don't we just fine tune something to get rid? But it's not a bad idea when you have just. It's not a bad idea to have this linear in terms of n. Cubic root of n behavior, because you see, once you see this linear behavior, you say, okay, I'm in the asymptotic regime already. And if you have something which doesn't have this asymptotic behavior, you don't really know whether you're in the asymptotic regime or not. And actually, that's what happened to Orel Bulgak. He basically was seeing no dependence on the density because he didn't have an access to low enough densities. Oh my! I'm already in the asymptotic regime because nothing depends on density. So, but in principle, you're right. It's possible. In principle, it's possible to play with some cutoff parameters and with the structure of this spectrum to get rid of this. And in our actual work, it's already published. We even provide two relations which should be satisfied to get rid of these leading corrections. So it's known what should be done. Basically, two integrals should be nullified. And it's possible because we have more than two parameters. It looks like possible. But we didn't do that. So these are the diagrams. And these are the diagrams for the partition function. These are just the standard diagrams, except that when we do analytics, we just have numerator and denominator. And we just get rid of disconnected diagrams. In this case, it's crucially important to have all the disconnected diagrams. In a minute, you will see why. Otherwise, it's just the standard diagrammatic technique. We have just local interaction, and we have fermionic propagators, and we work in real space and imaginary time. So the trick is to use so-called Rubtsov representation. Actually, we independently came to this representation, but realized that half a year earlier, everything was done by Rubtsov, so bad luck. So the idea is as follows. If you take some diagram of some given order, fix the space-time position of all the vertices, and consider all the diagrams which can be produced from this diagram by reconnecting propagators, you will see that your answer, the sum over all the diagrams, is nothing else but the square of the following determinant constructed out of propagators. Actually, it's just the product of two identical determinants. One determinant comes from spin-up particles, yet another determinant comes from spin-down particles. But if your interaction is delta functional, if it's local, the two determinants, they're formally different because one comes from spin-up particles, another comes from spin-down particles, but they're identically equal to each other. That's why we have just the square of determinants. And once our Green's functions are real, the square of determinants is positive definite. So we have what we need. We have a positive definite expansion, and it's convergent if the system is finite, because just any diagrammatic expansion is just the expansion of an exponential which converges for any finite system. But the price which we have to pay, so the diagram becomes extremely simple. It's just the simplest diagrammatic Monte Carlo, speaking diagrammatically, because the diagram now consists just of dots and nothing else. But the weight function which we have to calculate in our acceptance ratio now is weird. It's a determinant. So whenever we move, whenever we do some elementary update, we have to recalculate the determinant. So the price is really huge. That's why we need either just a cluster, or even better, a vector supercomputer, just to do these determinants. Otherwise, everything is trivial. We just do some elementary moves. And basically, this is some description of what we are doing. Actually, our configuration space consists of two types of diagrams. The diagrams for the partition function, which I introduced previously, and the diagrams for this important correlator. So this important correlator, this correlator plays the crucial part in the theory of Cooper pairing. So it's basically here we create a pair, and here we annihilate a pair, and here we create it. So basically, this guy gives us the density of the condensate of the Cooper pairs if we just integrate with respect to R. So it's really a good idea to sample this particular correlator. And there is a generic trick how to efficiently do that. The trick comes from our original Worm algorithm for simulating superfluids. When we actually do the same with the Green's function, when we have two special objects, we call them Worms, which correspond to creation and annihilation propagator, and in this case it's just creation and annihilation of a pair. So these red guys say this guy creates a pair and this guy annihilates a pair, and the whole updating scenario is basically done through updating these guys. For example, what can we do? We can take this guy and some neighbor. Just instead of having two, we will just cancel this neighbor, or just we can pretend that this guy jumps on this, and this guy becomes this brown vertex becomes a red vertex, and red vertex disappears. But these are details. So basically, we have some efficient, very efficient updating scenario called Worm algorithm for sampling, for simultaneously sampling two diagrammatic series. Two diagrammatic sectors, two diagrammatic subspaces. One subspace yields the diagrams for the correlator K, and another subspace yields the diagrams for the partition function. And we just sample everything in a unified process, very efficient. Well, okay, so let me just skip the details and just discuss how do we process the data, because the bad news is that we cannot do very large systems because we have to do determinants. But a good news is that the universality class of the phase transition is known. It's just 3D XY universality class, which means that we can actually accurately process the flow of our data as a function of system size, and we can just use our knowledge of the critical exponents and even just the knowledge of the leading corrections to the scaling so that we can...
It's a different
C, I guess. This, yes, sure. Okay, thanks. Yeah. No. It's just some constant. Okay, because it's a compilation of different slides of different presentation. Okay, so this omega is not a frequency. It's just the standard notation. Yes, you're right. Okay, so basically, just that's the good news. So we can properly process the data, trying to extract to the critical point and trying to access our systematic errors.
Q is just the integral?
It's the integral. Because
it's the integral of the off-diagonal correlation.
Yeah, and basically it's not that important because beta is an inverse temperature. It's essentially finite. Nothing would change if we do not do this integral. But numerically, it's very convenient to do this integral because then the estimator of this of quantity is very simple. You just count how many times how many times you spend in K sector as opposed to Z sector. It's like just one number, one integer over yet another integer. So the estimator for this guy, if you do this integral, is very simple. Otherwise, there is no physical, just physical importance in this integration. It's just all about numerical convenience. Otherwise, analytically, of course, we would do just this integration with respect to R, okay, and just try that. This is just the condensate density. It's just a technical detail, but very convenient. It simplifies the estimation. Okay, so these are our results. So as I was telling you, we can actually work with two different models. We can work with the Hubbard model, and we can just make it dilute, more and more dilute. And this is a good idea because previously people were simulating a dense Hubbard model.
Excuse me.
Yes.
You promised to tell us why it is important to calculate all these disconnected diagrams.
Oh, I told you. Okay. See? Yes. Because, okay. Let me just repeat it. Otherwise, we would not have this determinant. Because determinant arises only if we do all this. Suppose you want to get rid of this specific interaction and say, why don't we just introduce some T-matrix, which just to get rid of the details of the particular potential. Why don't we just introduce the T? But once we introduce the T-matrix, then we have to exclude ladder diagrams. And then this determinant trick doesn't work any longer, because we really need to interchange all possible propagators. Okay? Otherwise, we will not get the determinant. So these are the results for two different models. So this is just diluting Hubbard model. We see that we coincide with two different calculations. This is just the first principle calculation. There is an algorithm on a lattice which works very well for dense lattice systems. And actually, Orel Bulbeck and his group are using this particular algorithm. So we perfectly coincide with these calculations, which were done about 10 years ago, as far as I remember. And these are the recent calculations by dynamic mean field. Basically, they show the dynamic mean field works pretty good if the system is dense. Once again, the dynamic mean field would have a problem with going to a dilute system. And also, what we see here, we see that we have reached this asymptotic linear regime in terms of the cubic root of the density. This nu is the filling factor. So that's why we can just extrapolate this line towards this asymptotic value of critical temperature, which turns out to be 0.15 in the units of Fermi energy. So this is the result which we get from our Hubbard model, which we actually got some time ago. And this is our quite recent result. It's not published yet. So what did we do? We considered this continuous space model. And that's basically kind of answer to David's question. So you see, it's quite convenient just to use
the qualitative way to understand why the slopes are so enormously different.
I have no idea. But
the sign
of the correction.
Cubic Bruin zone cutting it off, and the other has a circle. But then inside this one, there's this curvature of the dispersion, whereas that one's purely quadratic.
I have no idea. But once we see that the signs of the corrections are different, we understand that we can have something in between which would go like that. But look, having this situation is not bad, because see, here the temperature, it's important. The higher the temperature, the smaller is the rank of our determinant. So here, it's not a good. Our temperature is low, so our actual temperature is high. So we have to work with a matrix of high rank. And here the rank of the matrix is smaller. So, presumably that's why here we had to work on a supercomputer, why this is doable on a cluster, just because the temperature is high. So
where's the separately point? It disappeared. Was
it on? Oh, excuse me.
Before?
Let me see. It disappeared. Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
<it's gone>.
Okay. Probably it's disappeared because it's biased.
Oh. It's good.
Or probably computer decided that it's not good enough. But actually it's biased. It's fixed node, variational approach. So
all the other people did fine.
Oh. So this is actually this. Let's discuss Orel Bulgak and his collaborator. Basically, he cannot go that far in diluting the system. Basically, he can work here, and what he sees is basically this part of the curve. And he keeps saying that look, in our case, we do not have this problem of diluting the system because nothing depends on the density. And indeed, if we just work on this regime, nothing depends on density, especially given the large enough error bars. That's the point. The dependence on density sets in the region which is not accessible to Orel. So
he just extrapolated horizontally.
Absolutely. He just says, okay, let's go here like that, and that's it. Because we can understand him, because once you see that it's just a horizontal line, why don't we just extrapolate like that? Okay, so that's the result, which we believe is quite accurate because we have reproduced it by two different models. Okay, and this is what we are doing at the moment. So we are running simulation for different. So this was the unitarity point. Now we have done the point which is shifted from unitarity, and this is what we are.
BEC side.
Yes, it's BEC side, because on the next plot we will see that BCS side is pretty boring, and actually everything this piece of line takes about a few months, so it's really painful painful simulation, and so that's what we have. So these are our two points. This is the unitary point. This is the new point, and here we are running our simulation somewhere here. So we see that basically we can figure out what's the tendency, especially if we take into account the result for bosonic system. So we know that for bosonic system there should be some weak maximum because of the competition between two effects. Quantum effects want to deplete the condensate, and the classical field effects actually of interaction want to make the critical temperature higher. So this is the competition of these two effects. That's why in any bosonic system we have a maximum of critical temperature as a function of density. And these are two characteristic examples: a bosonic model of hard spheres and a soft sphere bosonic model. So basically we see that we expect that our points, which we will add to this plot, will find them somewhere here. So basically the whole thing will go almost like this boson, maybe like here. But typically the amplitude of this effect of maximal increase of the critical temperature is not big in any model. So we think that it will not be just dramatic with these points. And in terms of the BCS side, we just see that somehow we just go towards this BCS limit smoothly.
So there was some controversy, I think, in the literature of how TC behaves on the BEC side. Even
here? In this limit, in the dilute limit, everything is under the control. We did it numerically. We know this. Actually, we did it.
It's understood analytically now too. It's just people were very confused about it.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's understood analytically, and the only unknown constant is some constant of order unity, which we established numerically. But there is no controversy.
Well, maybe what I meant by controversy.
There should be no controversy. There are still people who...
Yeah, but there are always people...
There was an amazing amount of...
Yeah.
...poor discussion.
Yeah. I believe that here everything is under the control, because when we go to this regime, it's basically the classical field problem. It's the problem of classical field. Everything is under the control.
The problem
of
critical fluctuations.
Absolutely, we are talking of critical fluctuations.
But so what I'm curious though still is that what is the value of that coefficient C?
This one. Oh, I cannot tell you at the moment, but we calculated. We calculated.
Okay.
Nikolai and me and.
Well, there's calculations of
BAME,
I guess.
Oh no. BAME is a biased analytic. So this coefficient is known. With accuracy of about few percent.
Numerically.
By two independent groups, Nikolai and me and Arnold and Moore.
Okay. So I'm curious how that compares to large end calculations of BAME or other calculations of people.
With some arrows of water, I don't know, 50% something. It's not, their calculations are not accurate, but they're not supposed to be accurate.
Yeah, that's true.
But everything is under control up to the numbers here. actually the whole fluctuation region, the thermodynamics of weakly interacting gas in the fluctuation region is now known. We just simulated it accurately with Nicolai. So any thermodynamic function in the fluctuation region is known, and any number like that is known in the fluctuation region of weakly interacting Bose gas. So everything is under control on this side.
I have another question.
Sure.
Would you agree with the statement that the existence of the maximum is easiest to conclude from knowing BCS and BC limits and knowing that C is positive? As long as there are these two, there's no
one. Oh, you mean qualitatively that there should? Sure, absolutely, absolutely. Should be the maximum. Sure. Absolutely, there's no question. The existence of the maximum is a theorem. It's a theorem because you know that this line goes like that. And this line starts from zero.
It could be two maximum.
Or even 15. So I cannot just, yeah, but at least one is there. Okay. At least one is guaranteed. Okay. And in terms of 15, we will see when we will just simulate this piece. But probably we will stop. We'll do
it. The method won't do well, right? Because the further you go to the molecules, it gets harder and harder, right?
Yeah. Because, yes. The rank of the matrix will grow. So probably we will stop. If our point will be somewhere here, we will probably stop because it will become boring. But we will.
You just want to get it up above BEC.
I know. We will see. Just give us half a year. We will put a point here and then we will discuss. Okay. So these are just thermodynamic curves, but let me just skip because I have only 10 minutes. I really want to discuss Fermi Polaroid. So basically, this is the illustration that we can do thermodynamics. This is the thermodynamics at unitary point. Actually, here, in contrast to the critical temperature, the agreement with Orel Bulgak's simulation is just perfect. And also, we have a zero temperature fluctuation, but by two groups, by fixed node method. But somehow, fixed node method works perfectly for zero temperature. So I would say that everything is under the control here, and this blue curve is the asymptotic behavior established by Jason Ho and Eric Müller. We see that we just slowly converge to this asymptotic behavior. We're not supposed to just be really close here because it's just a T over E Fermi on the order unity, and this asymptotic expression, it's actually a high temperature expression. Is not supposed to work very well. So everything looks.
Is there a way to do a systematic high temperature expansion to many orders in principle?
They just took into account just next. They just virial coefficient. No.
Numerically, the high temperature expansion.
Say it again.
I wonder if there's a way to carry out the high temperature expansion systematically to many
orders. Just the perfect question. That's what we are working on at the moment. We just want to do diagrammatically this high temperature expansion. Yes. That's exactly the project which we.
And then you can get the full curve all the way.
Absolutely. We just want to see. Because what just everything is there. The diagrammatic expansion, you just press the button and see. So we keep in mind.
But organize it as a power series and temperature.
No. Our plan is just to truncate the order of diagrams, order by order. Say the diagrams, because it looks like it will be an asymptotic series. So it will be divergent. But if temperature is high enough, we believe that if we will be truncating our series order by order, first we will see that converges, and then start to diverge. So basically, we plan to truncate the series order by order to see what happens.
In series in the diagram.
In the diagrams.
But you can't reorganize it as an expansion in beta.
I don't know. If you can reorganize, just provide us with a reorganized series and we will simulate it. Our idea was just very simple, just to work with the series as it is,
right.
Exact.
What you do is you would take your expressions,
Probably we can discuss it later, but our idea was just very simple, just to take diagrammatic series as it is. Why not? To see what happens, just to start with. Okay, so basically, these are my summary for the first part, and I really want to skip to the second one. So we have an approach which allows us to do just this problem of BCS, BSC crossover, and just in particular we obtained this important result for the critical temperature. So
actually, which problems have this kind of determinant representation for the partition function?
Fermion problems, fermionic problems with local interaction, because any fermionic problem will have a product of two determinants, because a determinant comes from all possible permutations. But you want this, actually you don't want a product of determinants, you want a square of determinants. And to have a square you have two identical determinants. And they will be identical only if you have two components interacting through the a local potential. Then they will be, all the propagators will be identical.
I see. The idea is that if I had a product, they wouldn't necessarily be real if it wasn't a square, and that would mean I had a sign problem.
Absolutely.
So something special about contact interactions between fermions.
And of course, propagators are supposed to be real. If you have some fancy problem in magnetic field when your propagator are complex, then you will have a trouble once again.
Well, if you had spinless fermions, in that case, probably your determinant will be a determinant of an anti-symmetric matrix, in which case it will still be positive.
In the case of spinless fermions, I do not see it because it will be just a determinant. The determinant is not supposed to be positive definite.
Well, he wants to do P wave, I think, right?
Right.
So you have.
Yeah, but I suspect that the matrix whose determinant will be computing will be fully anti-symmetric in that case. Maybe I'm wrong, but
I'm not sure. I'm not sure that. Why do you think it will be anti-symmetric?
Well, having to do with what happens if you change lines.
If it can order in a way that breaks time reversal symmetry, I bet it's got Lindsay sign problems.
I cannot react at once. We can discuss it later.
But, derivative of the delta function?
Excuse me?
The interactions are local, but some kind of derivative of the delta
function. We were never thinking of that, but probably you can just figure it out yourself, because you know what will happen, right? You will have to differentiate your propagators and see what happens.
But you take the determinant at fixed k's, right? Or you take your...
Everything is fixed, but it is in a fixed case, it's fixed r's, and these are fixed positions in space-time, because we want our propagators. I know actually what will happen if we will work with k's, but just it's just convenient to
promising for derivative
to work. But actually, you can. I gave you the idea.
Yeah.
Probably you can just answer the question yourself, because it has little to do with numerics. It's all about just the structure which you get. So it really has little to do with numerics. You can ask such a question yourself. So what happens when you just interchange all possible propagators for the given type of interaction? Okay, so let's just discuss this second part, and I'm reminding you that we are discussing the situation when we have a Fermi sea of spin up particles and one particle spin down, and we really want to see when this particle, which originally is a polaron, just a fermion dressed with particle holes of the background, which will it will become a molecule, which it will become which when it will form a bound state with yet another fermion, so when it will become a boson. So here we have the standard diagrammatic technique based on the following propagators. So we have a propagator of spin down, our only particle, our Fermi polaron. We have this T matrix. So this T-matrix is the exact solution of the scattering problem with the Fermi surface taken into account. And just let me tell you that this is the toughest problem in this business. So just to calculate this guy, because you do not have a nice analytic expression and you have to use some numeric techniques to calculate this guy. And once this guy is actually tabulated as a function of momentum and imaginary time, so we work at momentum and imaginary time representation, once this guy is done, at the moment it takes us about one day to tabulate this guy, the rest is the piece is a piece of cake. You just press the button and get your answer, maybe in minutes or in a half an hour, depending on just the accuracy you want to get. And we have two more propagators, which both of them, actually both of them come from this background, from spin up particles. One is the particle propagator, which corresponds to the momenta larger than Fermi momentum, and another one is the Hall propagator. And basically that's it. It's a typical diagram for the Polaron Green's function. So we have a backbone which is formed by this series of just vacuum propagator for spin-down particle, then T-matrix, vacuum propagator for spin-down particle, T-matrix, and so on. That's the backbone. And here we have these particle and hole propagators. The structure is very similar to the polarons, the standard polarons, Green's function, where we have replaced phonons with particles and holes. But the convergence properties are different. That's very interesting. And it was unexpected, actually, to us. And along with the polaron diagram, we have a molecule diagram. So the difference between the two is that this is a single particle channel or just zero particle channel in terms of the spin up. And here we have a two particle channel. So we have, in terms of the quantum numbers which this structure carries, we have spin down and spin up. So it's actually a two particle structure. So if we have a polaron, if our particle is a polaron, we have a pole in this guy. We would have a pole in this guy in the real frequency and momentum representation. And if we have a molecule, we will have a pole in this guy in the momentum and frequency representation, and no pole in this guy. So let's see what do we have here. So as I was telling you in the very beginning, we can easily simulate the structures. And basically, as I was also telling you, the main, actually, computational problem here is how to produce this T-matrix gamma. And we use a nice trick which we invented recently with Nikolai. It's called bold line diagrammatic Monte Carlo. It's a generalization of diagrammatic Monte Carlo. When the Green's function is simulated in terms of the expansion, which also contains the same Green's function. That basically, analytically, we call it bold line trick, when we just introduce bold lines. But there is some numeric trick which allows you to just to sample this function as well. So basically, we relate this gamma to the vacuum gamma. Vacuum gamma is the gamma, is the T-matrix for just two particles in the vacuum, and this gamma is T-matrix for one particle down and just the particle up with Fermi surface taken into account. So that's the equation which we have to solve, and we just do it numerically. Let me just skip this part because it's actually very interesting, maybe even more interesting than the rest of my talk. But just at the moment, I want just to skip this part. We have a preprint in the archive, so if you're interested in how this bold line diagrammatic Monte Carlo works, you can just look at this preprint. So once we tabulate, once we have this guy tabulated, we can just proceed with diagrams. And this is just these are two plots showing the issue of convergence. Because a priori, we do not know whether our series is convergent or not. And what we see here, that this series doesn't have an absolute convergence. So we sample our diagrams by their absolute values. And if we will write the partition function for the absolute values of the diagrams of the given order, so basically this is the order of diagram. By the order of diagram, we mean the number, say, of propagators gamma, the number of T matrices. So as a function of order, the absolute value, so by partition function, we just mean the sum of the absolute value of the all diagrams of the given order. So we see that in terms of the absolute value, the series which we are dealing with is divergent. So
what's mu?
Oh, it's a good question. Mu is some parameter which basically the energy of our particle in the vacuum. The physics doesn't depend on this mu, but numerically it's important. Otherwise, the process will diverge. We will start generating more and more.
Something to limit
It's something which limits the total number of diagrams if the series is convergent. If the series is divergent, even mu will not limit the total number of diagrams. So if the series is convergent, like in our case, we have to limit the total, the maximal number, the maximal order of diagram by hand. So that's what was done here. We just limited the number of the order of diagrams by 15, just to see what happened, and just made the simulation. That's why there is no the process converges, but it demonstrates that the partition function increases. And if you if I would just add more, you would see that it goes like that. But when we recall about the fermionic sign and calculate this partition function with sign taken into account, we see a perfect convergence. And in the case of Polaron, actually this is done at the unitary point. In the case of Polaron, we see actually something which was already known to people doing fixed node Monte Carlo. They noticed that for some reason all the physics of this Polaron is captured by just one simple diagram, by the diagram of the first order. They didn't know why, they noticed that what they see with fixed node is captured by a single diagram. And we see that, yes, indeed, the partition function for all the diagram is negligibly small as compared to this first diagram. The accuracy is better than 1%. So that's very interesting. And I do not know what's the reason, because we have no small parameter in this problem. Just the numbers. And in the case of a molecule, the behavior is quite weird. We see that actually the sign changes, but we still see the convergence, and we see the oscillations, which actually means that the convergence is much better, because these guys will be canceling each other, because they're pretty similar to each other when the order of diagram is large enough. So it's really good news. We see that actually fermionic sign is crucial for the convergence, and with the sign we will have this conversion, but we should be accurate. So basically, the procedure should be as follows. We have to fix some number of diagrams, say 5 or 6 or 7, produce some number, and then make sure that this number is independent of the cutoff in terms of the number of diagrams. And we indeed see that it's independent. But actually, the results are preliminary, because they were obtained only just a few days ago. So that's how we extract the energy. So just the most simple way is just to trace the asymptotic behavior of the Green's function at large imaginary time. But it's not a good idea, especially when you have the diagrams with sign, because if your imaginary time is large enough, you will have a lot of diagrams, and you will have just not very good accuracy because of this sign problem. The most industrial way and really efficient way is to use something which is very close to what we do analytically when we look for a pole in momentum frequency representation. A non-trivial, or at least non-trivial to us, fact is that actually, naively, we would think that first we have to do some analytic continuation, because we work in imaginary time. So we would think that first we would have to go from imaginary time to real frequency, which is a painful numeric problem, and only then we would be able to solve an equation like that. But it turns out that if we are looking for a pole, we do not need to do the explicit continuation. So basically, that's the answer, that's the bottom line. So that's the equation which we have to solve to find the spectrum. And that's the result, that's the typical result. So we take, as an example, we take the point K Fermi times A equals unity. It turns out that it's actually the point which is very close, almost, or maybe even exactly equal, because we cannot resolve the difference at the moment, to the point when the molecule and Polaron have one and the same energy. So these lines are just, let me just go back. So if I plot this function as a function of energy, so basically I have to find the point when this left-hand side hits the zero, and that will be my energy. So we see that for this particular value of the parameter K Fermi times A, the guys hit zero almost at one and the same point. There is some slight difference, and we believe that it's larger than our error bars, but let me just make a reservation. So let us check carefully that this is indeed the case. But the difference is very small. So we are really pretty close to the point when the molecular and polar terms cross each other at this point. And this is just a physical part, because if your energy is large enough, this expression actually, as is written on the previous transparency, is supposed to diverge. So just pay no attention to this behavior. It's unphysical, it's just some noise. So basically, only these parts of the curves are important. And this is the plot of polaron and molecular spectra as a function of K Fermi times A. So they cross, as I was showing you about, and at the point unity, and that's what we have at the moment. And here, just the molecular, speaking physically, here the molecule decays, but by the phase space argument, you can see that actually the width, the decay width of molecule here, and correspondingly the decay width of polaron here, will be, if we are pretty close to this this crossing point, will be much smaller than their energy. So the bottom line is that in this region of level crossing, actually both molecule and polaron are well-defined quasi-particles. So just these curves make perfect sense here. And if you go away from this point, here the notion of molecule becomes vague, becomes ill-defined. Correspondingly here, the notion of polaron is ill-defined because the guys just decay during the time of order unity in proper units. So basically, that's all I wanted to tell you. So the conclusion for the part two, that it works, and that the point when the energy cross is about one in terms of Guy Fermi times A. Thank you.
More questions?